Welcome to CME on ReachMD. This activity, titled Taking Action in Moderate to Severe Pediatric Atopic Dermatitis, Patient and Caregiver-Centered Approaches to Improve Outcomes, is provided by Clinical Care Options, LLC, in partnership with Practicing Clinicians Exchange, LLC, and National Eczema Association. Prior to beginning the activity, please be sure to review the faculty and commercial support disclosure statements, as well as the learning objectives.
We're going to start with talking about managing pediatric atopic dermatitis, patient-reported and caregiver-reported outcomes in practice. So another poll, according to surveys, what proportion of caregivers and children report sleep disturbances because of atopic dermatitis?
5 more seconds for incoming answers. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay, still split. So yes, we will talk about this as well. There's really a difference between sleep disturbances in patients with mild atopic dermatitis compared to severe atopic dermatitis. And so that actually does make this question a little bit tricky. Okay, so we're going to hear from a caregiver about the burden of pediatric atopic dermatitis.
In terms of as a caregiver, one thing is sleep. It impacts the quality of our sleep because depending on how your child, his symptoms are, if he's not sleeping well, you cannot sleep well, right? Then it starts impacting your work, your health. Other thing is that as a caregiver, you know, compared to a normal child, you have to do a lot more things. So you're always on the go. You have to plan a lot. And you also have to make sure that the moisturizers that you need to put them on, you have to put them. So everything adds up in terms of clothes. Since you're moisturizing, you need to wash them more often. If somebody's washing once a week, you're doing 3 times a week. So everything that adds up. So it's almost like you're in an emergency battle situation all the time.
So as you can hear, atopic dermatitis has a significant impact on quality of life of children and families. And it's also a really common problem. So trying to better treat atopic dermatitis is really important. It affects up to 20% of children. The onset's most common between 3 and 6 months of age. And of those diagnosed with atopic dermatitis, 60% develop the condition in the first year of life, and 85% of patients develop it by age 5. So most people, if they have eczema, they have eczema in childhood and in early childhood. Up to 60% of cases persist into adulthood, although usually for most patients, it's more mild in adulthood. But the disease course is very variable. It ranges from transient disease to relapsing, remitting atopic dermatitis to chronic, never goes away atopic dermatitis. There are 2 theories for the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis, the inside out and the outside in theory. And really, they're probably both true on a certain level. There's probably a loop here. So the inside out theory is that there is a pro-inflammatory environment, both locally within the cutaneous immune system and then activating the more widespread systemic immune system that leads to skin inflammation, which causes the cytokines causes barrier dysfunction. The outside in theory is kind of the opposite, where there is a barrier dysfunction, which leaves the patients more vulnerable to exogenous insults, exposure damages, which results in induction of inflammation. And again, there's probably a bad cycle going on here. It's definitely a chicken or the egg issue. And I don't think it really matters which of these theories is more true, so much as understanding what components of the immune system are involved, the barrier and the skin microbiome, to understand areas we can intervene to treat or prevent eczema. The patient burden, we heard from a father of a patient. We're going to talk a little bit about the burden on the patient and on the families. And so for these graphs, you'll see that the green boxes are patients with mild atopic dermatitis, the yellow are moderate atopic dermatitis, and the orange are severe atopic dermatitis. And there are, and we see here that patients with eczema report significant pain actually with their atopic dermatitis. And this is particularly true. It increases with severity. And so particularly common to have significant pain in patients with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. The burden of sleep is significant. This graph has a lot of information, but the kind of shortcut is that green is no days out of the week that are affected by, or sleep is affected by eczema. And then all the way to purple, where every day is affected by, sleep is affected by eczema. So you can see in our severe patients of all ages, a significant portion of them have every day affected sleep because of their eczema. And our moderate patients have at least some days of the week that their eczema is disturbing their sleep. So again, this is just reason to understand the burden a little bit more so we can be a little bit more proactive about treatment. The quality of life impact also, not surprisingly, increases with the severity of disease. And the increased severity is associated with lower quality of life and increased school absences. This is, again, true for all age groups. So 6 months, yes, maybe not school absences, but a lot of impact on sleep and other domains of the quality of life for the family. Okay, so how do we diagnose pediatric atopic dermatitis? Because to provide a treatment, you generally have to know that you have the right diagnosis. And it's a clinical diagnosis. We go off of historical symptoms and features. And it's basically the presence of two things. One is the typical morphology and distribution of skin lesions. So it looks like eczema, and it's in a typical pattern of eczema. And the patterns tend to change over time with specific ages. And then the other symptom that's required for atopic dermatitis is itch. So it's a typical look of eczema and itch. The differential diagnosis, it's pretty broad. Most of the time in my clinic, I can tell eczema is eczema. Every once in a while, it's a little trickier there. And sometimes patients have more than one thing going on. So trying to tease out what is what, which is important in terms of making sure you have the right treatment. So the differential diagnosis includes scabies, tinea for the pruritus of eczema. For the appearance of eczema, patients can have seborrheic dermatitis with atopic dermatitis. We particularly see that in infants. They can have impetigo or contact dermatitis. And then that chronic and or relapsing behavior we also see in things like psoriasis, photosensitivity, immune deficiencies. So making sure that we have the right diagnosis is key to providing the right treatment. I talked a little bit about that variability based on age, and this can be important when I'm unsure about the diagnosis. So I kind of if I'm trying to weigh two different diagnoses, then one thing that would be pro, yes, this is eczema, would be, is the pattern what we would expect for the age? In infants, we see a lot more involvement of the cheeks than the other ages. We also see more forehead and scalp involvement because of that overlap with seborrheic dermatitis. My theory on this is that the melasthesia that's normally on our body is kind of triggering atopic dermatitis early on. And so that's why we see them together a lot early in infancy. And then we see that those babies continue to have more typical atopic dermatitis. We also see extensor extremity involvement in infants as well as flexural creases, but the extensor extremities is a little bit more prominent in infants because it's the areas that they can like scratch or rub on a surface. In adolescents, we see more facial involvement compared to adults. We see neck involvement, especially the extensor neck. We start to see more palm and sole and ankle involvement, as well as that typical flexural crease involvement of atopic dermatitis. And adults still can have the flexural creases, but tend to have a lot more hand and foot eczema, particularly hand eczema. So it's very common for a patient to go through all these stages, start off with widespread involvement, seborrheic dermatitis, and atopic dermatitis overlap, and end up as an adult with chronic hand dermatitis. The other thing that's important in terms of making the diagnosis is understanding that eczema looks different on different skin colors. So on dark skin, we see more papular and follicular eczema, so more small dots of eczema. We see more post-inflammatory hyper or hypopigmentation, so more pigment changes in general. And the erythema isn't as obvious. It's more obscured by the thickening of the skin, the lichenification of the skin, and then just the darker color of the skin. So instead of looking bright red, the skin may look deep purple or purple-brown. And it's important to not underestimate the eczema and the active inflammation. In light skin, this is what we see in a lot of the textbooks, pink and red erythema, a little bit easier to see from the door that, okay, this is eczema until you get really comfortable with all the different colors of skin and how eczema looks a little bit different. In olive and medium brown skin, we tend to see still some of that pink erythema and pattern that we see in white skin. However, the erythema tends to be a little bit more purpley compared to lighter skin. Okay, clinical assessment tools. We hinted at this in the pretest, so we're going to just briefly talk about four. The first is the Eczema Area and Severity Index, and that is it's kind of a complicated score. You can do it by hand, but there's online calculators. And it's something that you can't just quickly do by hand, and you can't just like estimate it on your feet in clinic. So it's what percentage of each body area is involved, and then how much erythema, like lichenification, thickness, edema. So it's something that's used a lot for research or when we are trying to monitor progress of a patient. For example, if they're on biologic therapy, we want to show insurance that kind of gradual progression of improvement. Investigator global assessment is something you can do quickly on your feet. The scale is from 0 to 4, with 0 being clear, 1 being almost clear, 2 being mild, 3 being moderate, and 4 being severe. So that's something that we can quickly do in clinic and add that to our charts to have sort of a general gestalt of where the eczema is at in that moment. Score AD is very similar to EASI. It's used a little bit less commonly. It's used in some research studies. And then all three of these we can do just by looking at the patient without talking to anybody. We can do it after the patient leaves a clinic visit as long as we saw all of their skin. The one we cannot do without the patient participation is patient-oriented eczema measure. So this looks at how the eczema has affected the patient within the last week. So post-test one, which tool is best suited to integrate patient-reported outcomes into the assessment of disease severity in pediatric AD?
Poll is open. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay, perfect. Yep, exactly. So the patient-oriented eczema measure does include the input of the patients, and it's the only one that we can't do without talking to the patient. It focuses on, again, their frequency and severity of the symptoms over the past week, and so it's a valuable tool for integrating the patient-reported outcomes into severity assessments. And sometimes this is really important too when we are trying to escalate therapy for a patient, because sometimes things like itch and quality of life are significantly more than what we're actually seeing on the skin. And we don't want to underestimate that in our treatment. So I talked about the IGA, and it's important to understand kind of everybody be on the same page about what's mild, moderate, and severe atopic dermatitis. So mild atopic dermatitis is patches of dry skin, some itching, minimal impact on quality of life or sleep. It's usually patches that come and go that aren't particularly persistent, but just, you know, here and there without significant cracking or fissuring of the skin. Moderate atopic dermatitis tends to be more diffusely dry skin, frequent itching and excoriation. Skin redness is more obvious and there's significant impact on quality of life and sleep. We tend to see more body surface involvement and more persistence of atopic dermatitis. Severe eczema is large areas of dry skin, large areas of involvement of the atopic dermatitis, constant itching, redness, and excoriation, and at this point, this is strongly interfering with the daily routine and sleep. So severity can be both the body surface area and the, I guess I should say the body surface area, the quality of life impact, or you can also have focally severe eczema where it's so thick and open and bleeding in specific areas. That's what we call focally severe. Okay. So the foundation for every patient for non-pharmacologic therapy is what we just call gentle skincare. So gentle skincare is trigger avoidance. Some patients do have environmental allergies that can trigger the eczema, but most patients who have eczema, you're not going to find an allergy that is going to cure their eczema. So it's very important that we help patients understand the distinction between those two things. We do recommend baths or showers daily to every other day, with a non-soap or mild cleanser, so a non-irritating cleanser. But we do want patients to bathe actually a little more frequently than was historically recommended because of this interplay with the skin microbiome, which can cause more inflammation if it's unbalanced. And in a similar vein, bleach baths can be helpful. Honestly, the research is kind of plus minus for bleach baths. Some patients really like them. For the patients who have a lot of open areas, and for the patients who kind of have that constant disturbance of the skin microbiome or frequent infections, then we can offer bleach baths. Moisturizers are sort of everybody has to do it, because there is, whether it's inside out or outside in, there is a skin barrier problem. And so we have to protect that skin. We recommend applying it liberally immediately after bathing, reapply throughout the day. Ideally, in our kids, we want to see twice a day moisturization after the topical medications are applied. Practically, I know it's really hard to do, so at least that time after the bath is really important. And Ointments in general are thought to seal in hydration and decrease evaporation more than a thinner product like a lotion. So we recommend a thick cream or an ointment. In 2024, the AAD updated their algorithm for treatment of atopic dermatitis. And you can see in the key up on the top that the blue circles are recommendations that they supported, and the green circles are going to be recommendations against. So in the to start for baseline management, like we just talked about, we've talked about assessing for signs of disease, assessing the severity, talking about the quality of life, identifying any relevant triggers. And then the baseline therapy, strongly recommend moisturizers and emollients. And then you can see the conditional recommendation for bathing practices, because like I said, with bleach baths, overall, we're leaning towards more frequent bathing, but there's not great data that says clearly this is the best way to bathe. When we move on within the recommendations to topical therapies, these kind of from mild to severe, pretty much every patient who has atopic dermatitis, unless it's contraindicated for some reason, they should have a topical therapy as part of their plan. And the standard is topical corticosteroids. They've been around for a long time. They are safe when used appropriately. We also have topical calcineurin inhibitors. That includes pimecrolimus and tacrolimus. They've also been around for a long time. Crisaborole is a little newer to the market, and ruxolitinib also a little newer to the market for atopic dermatitis. We have a harder time getting those sometimes with insurance coverage. Wet dressings, you can see that there's kind of a conditional wishy-washy recommendation. I don't think they're harmful. We used to do them a lot in my practice before we had biologics. That's where you apply a medication or a moisturizer followed by a damp clothing or gauze. The idea is to kind of push the medication into the skin from the occlusion. Again, though, there's not really research that supports that this was a significant, there's a significant difference when you do that. It's just more anecdotal than what we see in clinic. And then we have two new treatments coming to the market that we'll talk a little bit more about later. They are not on the guidelines from 2024 yet because they have come out since the guidelines were produced. And then maintenance therapy, we talked about this a little bit in terms of like gentle skincare and continuing to do that. But the reactive treatment is the applying the topical therapies when there's an actively inflamed area. We also recommend proactive application. We'll talk about that in a little more detail to maintain control in recurrently inflamed sites. So that means if the eczema is like a fire, when that fire is blown up, yes, you need to apply the topical medicines twice a day, for example, or once a day, whatever the recommendation is for that specific topical. But then when the eczema goes away, if we know it's chronic, then we can apply medication intermittently to keep that fire from even starting to come back. Shared decision-making is important for long-term treatment. It's important. You can't get a family to adhere to a treatment plan if they're not on board. And any inadequate control with what we've talked about so far, you should always reconsider the diagnosis. Is there something else we're missing? And then consider going to the next step. And the next step is phototherapy and systemic therapy. Phototherapy, you can see the conditional recommendation has been around for a long time. It's very safe. However, it's just practically very difficult for patients to do. It's usually offered in our offices. And then systemic therapies, we're going to talk about more. The biologics, dupilumab, tralokinumab, and lebrikizumab. And then the JAK inhibitors, upadacitinib, abrocitinib, and baricitinib. And then we have the older medications that were around before we had the biologics and JAK inhibitors, methotrexate, azathioprine, cyclosporine, and mycophenolate mofetil. So you can see that there is a strong recommendation for all of the newer therapies, and there is a kind of conditional, if you really have to, recommendation for the older immunosuppressants. And that in general, as dermatologists, we do not recommend systemic corticosteroids for atopic dermatitis because of the tendency to flare after you stop. Okay, what proportion of caregivers of children with moderate to severe AD are satisfied with available treatments? 30 to 39%, 40 to 49%, 50 to 59%, 60 to 69%, or greater than 70%?
Poll is open. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay. Yes, I didn't give it away this time that it was bolded, but yes, 40 to 49%. So less than half of caregivers are satisfied with the available treatments for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. So that is a huge gap that we need to address. So let's hear from a patient perspective about her experience with topical therapies.
While I'm not exactly familiar with the name of the drug, when I was little, my father took me to this allergy doctor place where they gave me shots. But after a few months, I stopped going there and I later transitioned into topical steroids. And I would say topical steroids help with the appearance, but it doesn't really do anything for the itch in my experience. And because of these topical steroids, when I wouldn't exactly know how much is the right amount to put on my skin. So sometimes when I put too much of the steroids on my arm, it would be white scars. So I actually have a scar on my arm now.
So that was one patient perspective. I don't think that topical steroids leave scars. So that's just a good example of patients like really making sure that they understand what the risks and benefits are of the treatments that we're offering and know how to use them, because you could hear her hesitation with, I wasn't sure how much to use or like when I should be using it. So our available topical therapies, again, the standard is non-responsive to that gentle skincare and moisturization routine. They're applied once to twice a day. And it's important to address steroid phobia and assess adherence up front. In general, you know, like we just heard from this patient, there's not a lot of evidence to support the amount of fear that we have around topical steroids. So I've used topical steroids in thousands and thousands of patients, and I've seen only a couple of cases of skin thinning, for example. Calcineurin inhibitors, tacrolimus ointment, and pimecrolimus, second line, they've been around for a long time. One of the problems here is that they're approved for patients only down to age 2, which is just the FDA approval. It's really tricky. They're commonly used in younger children, but sometimes this is an issue where we're trying to avoid using a topical steroid in a younger child, for example, on the face or around the eyes, and then it's just not approved for a child that's less than 2. So it's not available. The other thing that's tricky about the calcineurin inhibitors is they can burn or sting on actively inflamed skin. So they're really better for working them into the topical regimen once the topical corticosteroids have quieted down the inflammation. There is a theoretical risk of secondary infections and rare cases of malignancy. However, multiple studies have been done that kind of debunked this myth. There's just a black box warning on there that's been removed in Canada, but we still have it in the United States. And again, practically in clinical practice, I've not seen that. PDE inhibitors, so this is crisaborole and roflumilast, safe and effective options for mild to moderate atopic dermatitis. Crisaborole is approved for down to 3 months. Roflumilast is approved for 6 years and older, and that one is just more recently approved within the 2024 guidelines like we talked about. So the PDE4 inhibitors, they're kind of tricky because sometimes insurance coverage is an issue. They are indicated for mild to moderate atopic dermatitis. They're not indicated for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. They are under treatment for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. And my experience is they're kind of like a little bit of a crapshoot. Like for some patients, they work well, and other patients, they don't work well. JAK inhibitors, topical ruxolitinib, it's approved for adolescents 12 and older. It's reserved for patients who do not respond to other treatments, and is approved for short-term and non-continuous treatment. But you have to watch if there's a lot of body surface area. You're not supposed to exceed 20% body surface area or a certain amount of the medicine per week. This is super tricky because our patients who maybe have gotten to the point where they want to use a JAK inhibitor topically because they failed topical corticosteroids, they usually have a lot of body surface area of eczema. And then finally, we have tapinarof cream, which is approved for patients greater than 2. Haven't had a lot of chance to use this with insurance approval yet. The most common side effects included upper respiratory infection, folliculitis, headache, asthma, vomiting, pain in the extremities. So for me, there hasn't been a place to mix this in yet, just again, based on insurance approval. So kind of to be continued. The financial burden of topical therapy is not insignificant. The patients report and parents report significant out-of-pocket cost, spending on topical medications, those moisturizers we talked about, cleaning supplies. And the first patient perspective, the father that we heard from, touched on this, all the burden of, you know, having to wash the clothes more frequently, things like that. The yearly median out-of-pocket cost is around $600, but almost half of patients spend more than $1,000 a year. Emollients are universally recommended, but they can range from very cheap, like plain Vaseline, plain petroleum jelly, to being up to like $10 an ounce. And only 12% of the top recommended moisturizers are free of contact allergens, which not every patient with atopic dermatitis has contact dermatitis, but sometimes our patients with atopic dermatitis do have concomitant contact dermatitis, and it can be really hard to tease those out if you don't know what moisturizer they're using. Safety concerns with topical corticosteroids, again, they're commonly used. We use them for a lot of pediatric dermatologic conditions. Reported adverse drug reactions are rare. They're generally associated with higher potency. So we have seven different strengths to seven different potencies of corticosteroids. They're mostly associated with the class one and two steroids and with longer treatment duration. So that's really important. The most common clinical scenario where I see topical corticosteroid side effects is when a patient just got refills of a medication without somebody like stopping to realize, and they were just applying the medication even when the condition was gone for months and months. And those side effects that we could see include telangiectasia, striae, hypopigmentation, and skin thinning. They're usually applied twice a day, but once a day might be considered for some patients and for some topical steroids. And practically speaking, I tend to tell my patients to use them twice a day because practically speaking, as a parent, I feel like if I try to do something every day and I skip a day here or there, then sometimes there's like 48 hours between doing it, right? Versus if you try to do it twice a day and you miss here and there, you're probably at least getting the medicine on once a day. But every like patient and family is different. So sometimes that might not be needed. Phototherapy we talked about as part of that maintenance therapy or as part of stepping up from the mild to moderate atopic dermatitis to the moderate to severe, but the access is an issue. And the clinicians, it's becoming increasingly difficult for us as dermatologists to maintain these machines based on how much we're using them because there are newer medications like biologics. And then it's a little tricky in terms of us like dosing the phototherapy, how much dose they get. And then if they go on vacation and come back, it's a little bit tricky. It's not as standard as like a biologic that just comes in a pre-filled pen. And clinic-directed home therapy is possible. We used to do a lot more of this 10 to 15 years ago. Now we don't need it as much, but it is a option. The potential side effects would be the accumulation of the chronic sun damage, although it is a focused UV wavelength. So we would expect less actinic damage than just being in the sun for the same duration. But you can still burn. You can become itchy, stinging. Phototherapy is not for everybody. And then again, practically speaking, just coming in to do phototherapy is tough. So when do we initiate systemic therapy in children with atopic dermatitis? We talked about in the mild to moderate atopic dermatitis patients, we talked about the non-pharmacologic measures, the gentle skincare, the moisturizers for everybody, and then optimizing topical therapy. For moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, we're going to do all of those things. And then a lot of times we're going to end up adding systemic therapy if our patients aren't under control with the non-pharmacologic and topical options. Candidates for systemic therapy, about one third of pediatric patients with moderate to severe eczema are inadequately controlled with topical therapies. So that is too big of a number. We have too many options now for us to still have a third of patients that are inadequately controlled. The decision to initiate systemic therapy should be collaborative between the healthcare provider and the patient caregivers. And we consider systemic treatment for children with atopic dermatitis with inadequate response to or intolerance of topical therapies. However, it's a big step because whenever we go from topical therapy to systemic therapy, everything involves needles. So either injections or lab monitoring. So there's a big leap between there, but it's also something that is necessary for treatment success. So before we do that, before we jump, because everything after this includes needles, we check like, okay, we're not ever getting the patient clear. Okay, then we have to go to systemic therapy. They're having a hard time adhering to the treatment because of the frequent and the widespread application of topical. Okay, then we have to go to systemic therapy if there's frequent environmental triggers or ongoing severe eczema. So sometimes we just have to take that leap, and we want our patients to have a better quality of life. When we are deciding on a systemic therapy with the family, we take a few things into consideration. The first is like, what kind of eczema do they have? Again, some patients have focally severe eczema. Some patients have widespread eczema. Some patients have itch that's disproportionate to their eczema. And those things can affect the treatment decision. Patient comorbidities, for example, if they also have asthma, sometimes that aids us in terms of leaning toward the biologic because, for example, dupilumab is also indicated for asthma. Risk-benefit profile of the available treatments, of course, patient preferences, of course, because oral therapies versus giving themselves home injections, some people just are not able to do home injections, drug interactions and clinical monitoring, and access to treatment. So traditional systemic therapy, before we had biologics and JAK inhibitors, we would use the old immunosuppressants that I briefly touched on earlier, cyclosporine, azathioprine, methotrexate, mycophenolic acid, and we would continue the topical therapies. We try really hard to avoid systemic steroids like I talked about, because a lot of times we see that flare after we stop, and it's not a helpful cycle. But the problem is, for traditional systemic therapies, everything except for cyclosporine takes a while to kick in. So if patients are really, really miserable, one of the things we can do is we can do a temporary bridge with cyclosporine. But these other options I used to use a lot 6 or 7 years ago, and now I use them fairly infrequently. Safety considerations, we won't get into all of this, but all of these medications have side effects. They're either hard on the kidney or hard on the liver, or can cause bone marrow suppression. So they do require lab monitoring. So we don't have an oral medication that we can give patients that is safe for long-term use that doesn't require lab monitoring. So that's why I said there's no like needle-free option really. So thankfully we have biologics. They do still involve needles in one way or another, but they are more targeted, right? We're not turning down the whole immune system. We're focusing on a part of the immune system that we know is active in atopic dermatitis. So for dupilumab, that's acting on IL-4 and IL-13. For the newer ones, lebrikizumab and tralokinumab, it's acting on IL-13. And then the JAK inhibitors, of course, are acting on JAK1 or JAK1 and 2. So the newer FDA-approved systemic agents, and we're going to go through them individually. This is just an overview of what is approved for each age group. So dupilumab is the only one that's approved for down to 6 months. It's the most common one used in our practice in terms of the first line for a systemic agent. Fairly easy to get from insurance when it's appropriate and indicated. And then the JAK inhibitors, tralokinumab and lebrikizumab, are approved for 12 years and up. Biologic therapy use in atopic dermatitis has a lot of benefits. It can be done at home. It can be self-administered. The reason this is important, because sometimes in the past things like omalizumab were tried, and that needed clinical monitoring at the beginning. So it's nice to have a biologic that we don't have to do an infusion in the office, and it could just be done at home. They work well. We'll talk about that. And they're really well tolerated in trials and in real life. And there's no routine laboratory monitoring needed for dupilumab and the other biologics. Safety considerations are the same amongst the three of them. There's this kind of strange conjunctivitis that happens that I've seen a few times. It's usually temporary right after you start the medication. You can treat with artificial tears or over-the-counter mast cell stabilizer drops. If it's severe, you can refer to ophthalmology, but again, usually it's temporary, thankfully. Of course, injection site reactions, headache, and upper respiratory infections, which are non-specific, but were reported with the biologic use. And then vaccinations is a little tricky because there's not really guidelines right now on what to do with vaccinations in children who are on biologic therapy. But in general, pediatric dermatologists feel that because dupilumab, for example, is not largely immunosuppressive, that it's appropriate to continue with the vaccination schedule. But the current recommendation is to withhold live vaccines. So that's kind of, again, another to be continued issue that will hopefully be sorted out soon. So let's talk a little bit about the trial data that allowed us to have these new tools. The first is dupilumab, which again, it acts on the IL-4 receptor alpha inhibitor, inhibits the signaling of IL-4 and IL-13, and is approved all the way down to 6 months now, thank goodness. You can see in the studies here, the efficacy was pretty high. The EASI 75 means that there's a 75% improvement in that EASI score that I touched on earlier. And then the 90, same thing, 90% improvement in that score. IGA 0 or 1, as a reminder, is either clear or almost clear. That's a really high goal for patients that have moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, to be completely clear or almost clear. So these numbers, although the IGA 0 to 1 looks a little bit lower. Those are actually pretty good numbers considering the severity of the disease that kids usually have if they're put on these medications. The other thing that has been explored for dupilumab is the long-term efficacy and safety up to 52 weeks, so up to a year. And it continued to be safe and effective throughout the entire time. So it's not something where we're seeing that patients are typically losing efficacy shortly after they start the medication. And then tralokinumab was next. It's an IL-13 inhibitor approved for the treatment of moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. You can see that the numbers are a little bit lower on the IGA 0 to 1 and the EASI scores. But again, this is a little bit different depending on the age groups that are studied and the design of the trial. So this is approved now down to age 12. Very similar dosing strategy to dupilumab. And then finally, lebrikizumab, which acts on free IL-13. And it's approved for the treatment of moderate to severe atopic dermatitis just recently in kids down to 12. And again, you can see the outcomes from the studies, pretty good, EASI 75 and EASI 90 at 16 and 52 weeks. And the IGA 0 to 1 at 52 weeks of 63% is pretty good. Again, a good safety profile with some kind of generic upper respiratory infections, headache, atopic dermatitis. We haven't really seen with these drugs significant scary side effects that have limited the use. JAK inhibitors. So JAK inhibitors are used for a wide variety of diseases versus the biologics we talked about are a little bit more focused. So JAK inhibitors were studied for atopic dermatitis in the JADE regimen study. And they were ultimately approved for adolescents 12 and up. And you can see really pretty good numbers similar to the biologic data for adolescents. An IGA 0 to 1 of 60% is great at week 12. And then the EASI 75 of around 72%. Not significant serious side effects, but you can see in the adults some more serious side effects and some serious infections. And then upadacitinib was also studied and approved down to age 12 with overall similar data and similar concern for some serious adverse effects and serious infections. So the systemic therapy is approved for use in patients with inadequate control or contraindications to other therapies, including biologic agents. So for patients who aren't able to give themselves a shot at home, JAK inhibitors can be a good option, or for patients who lose the response to the injected biologics, this can be a good option. The potential benefit of JAK inhibitor is there's concern that patients that are on the biologics will eventually develop antibodies to it. And some patients prefer oral therapy over injecting themselves. And then the potential for long-term use to control the disease if tolerated well. And I think this is true for both the biologics and the JAK inhibitors. However, the side effects of the JAK inhibitors are a little bit more concerning. We have to watch the CVCs, the LFTs, lipids, watch for signs and symptoms of infection. And there's a little bit more of a malignancy and thrombosis risk compared to placebo. That is something that we are seeing in real life. Okay, post-test 2. Which of the following pediatric patients with moderate to severe AD would be the best candidate for a biologic therapy? So this is a biologic therapy, not a JAK inhibitor. A 10-year-old with mild asthma showing partial improvement with low potency topical steroids but poor adherence. 15-year-old with seasonal allergic rhinitis, frequent flares, bad sleep, fear of needles. 7-year-old with occasional flares, controlled, reporting mild itch. A 13-year-old with recurrent infections, significant quality of life, and experiences no relief from topical steroids and topical calcineurin inhibitors.
Poll is open. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Let's see. Okay. Yep. D. Now, I agree with the people. I would still offer the biologic to the 15-year-old. So I completely agree. I kind of hinted at this earlier, this question. The 13-year-old is kind of a clear cut. Okay. Recurrent infections, the topical steroids aren't working. Next step would be to go to dupilumab but you could really do lebrikizumab or tralokinumab as well because they're approved. But most of the time we'll start with dupilumab based on the formulary. A 15-year-old who is still having frequent flares and is significantly impacted, sometimes we can work with the fear of needles. And remember, if we offer something like JAK inhibitors, there's still lab monitoring. So we're not completely getting away from needles, but it's something to discuss. Like, would you rather do lab monitoring or would you rather work on your fear of needles and do injections at home? Okay. So collaborative patient-centered and caregiver-centered approaches to managing children with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. So this is what I'm talking about when we're talking about the specific patients, right? So we can't make the decision on our own completely. We have to see what patients and parents' preferences are and what their limits are. Which of the following is not a common trigger of AD flares in children? Soap and detergent, soft fabrics like silk or cotton, viral and bacterial skin infections, or extreme weather fluctuations?
Poll is open. Please vote. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay, yes. Also bolded, so good job. Soft fabric like silk or cotton, yes, is not a common trigger of atopic dermatitis flares. And we'll talk about what is. So when we are working with a family to decide how to treat the atopic dermatitis, sometimes we use something called an action plan. And an action plan, you can find various examples online. It basically has three components, where the green is the maintenance routine, the mild is the mild to moderate flares, and the red is, okay, what do you do when there's really bad flares? And so having the patients know what they're supposed to do at each of those steps is part of the treatment, because we can't have treatment if patients don't understand when and how to use their medications. Part of the maintenance is avoiding common triggers, including environmental allergens, dust mites, pollen, and contact allergens that, again, can trigger atopic dermatitis. They don't cause it per se, but can trigger it. Climate, we tend to see eczema flares in low humidity. So in Florida, for example, this time of the year when the air is a lot drier than in the summer, in extreme heat or extreme cold. Irritants, wool or rough fabrics can be causing irritant dermatitis that triggers atopic dermatitis, as well as saliva, sweat, harsh soap, detergent, fabric softeners, dryer sheets. Again, all contain triggering an irritant dermatitis that then triggers atopic dermatitis. And then infections. This is kind of a chicken or the egg thing, where these infections, they like Staph aureus and molluscum, they basically like to happen on eczema skin. And then when they do happen on eczema skin, they tend to make the eczema worse. So I wanted to go back a little bit to the proactive treatment of atopic dermatitis flare-ups, because this is something that has changed in my practice compared to when I was in training 15 years ago. And so instead of just treating the flares, like you can see in the top with the graphs of red, where we're just kind of treating the flares to try to get patients down to like, okay, you just treat until you kind of can't see the eczema anymore. And then I see this a lot in my practice, patients who are referred because they're like, okay, I was told to use a topical steroid for 7 days. And after 7 days, like the eczema is almost gone, but not completely. So then they stop using the medication, the eczema comes right back. They go back down to the 7 days. It's almost gone, but not completely. And you just keep going through the cycle. Instead, what I tell patients is I want you to use the topical medicine 2 times a day until that eczema is completely gone, and then a little bit more, because you want to completely put out the fire. And then once we get the fire out, we don't want it coming back. So we're going to put a little bit of medication on. We usually do this 2 to 3 times a week. The most common regimen I recommend is to just apply the topical medication once a day on each day of the weekend. And this is, again, just putting a little bit of water on the fire here and there to keep those embers from going back into a full flame. There's a few very good studies on this that show that it reduces flares by at least 50%. And it's something very small that you can do in your clinical practice if you're not doing to help your patients get better control. And then another issue that comes up with families in terms of trying to problem solve is, when do we discontinue biologics? And the short answer is, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows quite yet. There's no consensus. In one of the trials, the patients that stopped the medication, stopped dupilumab, over half of them relapsed and restarted dupilumab. So I usually tell patients when we're starting dupilumab, we're on it for at least a couple of years before we consider. And it depends on their age, like how likely they are to grow out of the eczema, how severe it is, what the pattern is. But we know eczema is a chronic problem, so we don't have a good stopping point for a chronic problem. Discontinuation requires time and patient caregiver buy-in, because if you stop the medication, then the eczema is going to come back, and then it's going to take a while for the medication to kick in again. So you're setting yourself up for being kind of without the medication, actively keeping the eczema away for a couple months at least. And shared decision-making in atopic dermatitis, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning in one of the questions. It's really important. We can't really be effective in treatment if we don't get buy-in from our families. So actively listening and engaging patients and their caregivers, accommodating various economic and appointment needs, facilitating closer follow-up when needed and desired. So if I have patients who don't have a lot of health literacy and they're confused on the plan, then I try to just do one thing at a time, have them come back more frequently, considering patient goals, preferences, and cultural skincare practices, assisting with medication access and support resources. So employing motivational interviewing when you're trying to come up with a plan with a family involves four things: engaging, building rapport with taking into account the patient's point of view and forming an alliance, asking permission to examine, asking permission to progress the treatment plan, focusing, like, what does the patient want to discuss? Like, what's the most important part of the eczema to you? Is it the sleep disturbance? Is it the itch? Is it the appearance? Because kids are making fun of you. Knowing like what problem of the chronic condition is most important to them to focus on. And presenting evidence of risks and benefits in patient-friendly language is really important. And talking about the advantages of disadvantages to not making a change. And this comes up a lot in clinic for me too. Like, we could go forward if you're not happy, but if you're happy, we can stop where we are and we don't have to go to biologics. There's a lot of time that's like, here's the advantage of going forward to biologics. Here's the advantage of not, and just staying where we're at. And then evoking, trying to get more from the patient, from the family. What are the patient's ideas and solutions? And waiting and listening, asking open-ended questions. What do you think about this? Or how do you believe you can get your medicines on more? Or tell me more about why you can't apply your medicines. And then plan, having a plan, making sure you're on the same page about the plan to collaboratively identify the next steps involved to move toward change. So knowing what the goal is, and then how would you do that? What do you believe is the first next step? What can I do to support you? So now that we discussed this a little bit, which of the following phrases best aligns with motivational interviewing principles to address a caregiver's concerns about initiating systemic therapy? Is it A, I understand this is a big decision. Here's why I think this treatment's best for your child. B, you seem concerned about starting a new treatment. What is your main worry about this option and how can I address it for you? C, it's important to remember that all treatments have risks and this one is no exception. I recommend it despite the risks. Or D, we've tried everything else and this treatment's the only option left. Let's move forward with it.
Poll is open. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay. Most people picked B because we're including a question. I don't think A is awful either. There's a lot of times where that's part of the conversation that I have still with parents, saying, okay, this is why I think this is best. But then being like, what are the barriers for you? I think can still be part of the conversation because a lot of times that's what families are asking me, like, what do you think is best? And I always say, I'm going to treat your child just like I would treat my own as a parent. Option B exemplifies motivational interviewing by exploring the caregiver's emotions and concerns, encouraging open communication, and promoting shared decision-making. So that's the difference between A and B. Of A is, and again, it's just, it depends on the relationship you have with the family. A is you telling them a little bit more of here's what we're going to do versus B is trying to evoke a little bit more from them. All right, post-test number 4, we're almost done. After participating in this program, how confident are you in your ability to treat atopic dermatitis in pediatric patients? Not confident, somewhat not confident, somewhat confident, confident, or very confident?
Poll is open. All right, thank you. We'll close the poll and share the results.
Okay, we made some progress. We moved from B's and C's to C's and D's, and that is perfect. I don't expect anybody to become an expert and fully confident within an hour, but I think understanding how to tweak your topical therapy approach and knowing when to go to systemic therapy can really increase your confidence in terms of managing your pediatric patients with atopic dermatitis. So key takeaways, atopic dermatitis significantly impairs quality of life for patients and caregivers. Topical therapy remains first line. However, their use can be a burden. Newer systemic options are available for patients with severe or refractory atopic dermatitis. Engaging patients and caregivers in shared decision-making is imperative to improve self-management, adherence, and quality of life. And then developing patient-specific action plans to address barriers and to care for atopic dermatitis to optimize the outcomes is important. So there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. There's a lot of different permutations of how we can treat atopic dermatitis, and it really depends not only on what I think is best, but also what the patient family want. So with that, it's a lot to cover at kind of the end, but if you guys have any time for questions, I'm happy to take them.
We're now taking any questions you may have for Dr. Shook. Please use the Q&A function in Zoom. And while you do so, we'll have some QR codes on the screen momentarily. And we also have links in the chat panel. One would be for the downloadable slide deck from today's presentation, and the other would be for the program evaluation link to complete and claim your credit. And you'll need to log into or create a CCO account. Please claim your credit within 30 days, as it will expire after this time. Are there any one final opportunity for any questions? Okay, Dr. Shook, I don't see anything coming into the Q&A panel. So are there any other comments you have for us today?
I don't think So I think just kind of knowing what's on the horizon and what's available and when to move to the next step is as much as we can expect to learn in an hour. So watch out for the to be continued that I discussed as well. There's hopefully going to be a few new options available to us in the future.
You have been listening to CME on ReachMD. This activity is provided by Clinical Care Options, LLC, in partnership with Practicing Clinicians Exchange, LLC, and National Eczema Association. To receive your free CME credit or to download this activity, go to reachmd.com/CME. Thank you for listening.